Matthieu Ricard is a French-born Tibetan Buddhist monk and a central figure in the Dalai Lama's dialogue with scientists. He was dubbed the happiest man in the world after his brain was imaged. Matthieu Ricard resists this label, but he has written a provocative book in which he explores happiness not as a pleasurable feeling, but as human flourishing, a way of being that gives you the resources to deal with the ups and downs of life and that encompasses many emotional states, including sadness. This hour, we experience Matthieu Ricard's way of being, and we take in his very practical teachings for cultivating inner strength, joy, and direction.
You cannot, in the same moment of thought, wish to do something good to someone or harm that person. Those are mutually incompatible, like hot and cold water. So the more you will bring benevolence in your mind, at every of those moments, there's no space for hatred. That's just very simple, but we don't do that. No, we do exercise every morning, 20 minutes to be fit. We don't sit for 20 minutes to cultivate compassion. If we were to do so, our mind will change, our brain will change, what we are will change.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Krista Tippett. Today, On Being, the happiest man in the world, meeting Matthieu Ricard. The author of several globally best-selling books, Matthieu Ricard resides at the Seichen Monastery in Nepal. There he also coordinates a number of humanitarian projects. And he's been the Dalai Lama's French interpreter for over 20 years. He had a secular upbringing in France with an artist mother and a famous philosopher father. Growing up, he had lunch with the composer Stravinsky. The photographer Cartier-Bresson came for dinner at his family home. And Matthieu Ricard was surrounded in adulthood by brilliant scientists. He began his professional life in the cellular genetics laboratory of a Nobel Prize-winning biologist at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. I sat down with Matthieu Ricard a couple of years ago in Vancouver, Canada, at a gathering with the Dalai Lama, Nobel laureates, scientists, educators, and social activists. You know, I interview people who do many different things and come from many different traditions and professions, and I always ask, as a starting question, if you'd tell me a little bit about the spiritual background of your life.
Which is
a different, which in, if you ask someone that in the United States, even if they're not religious, you always get a really interesting story. But really interesting. But I think in France, it's a different kind of question.
It would be an interesting story.
Yeah. I mean, but I know your father was a philosopher, but was there any kind of secular spirituality?
I don't know. Spirituality, for me, if you look at the roots, means something to do with the mind, yeah. Dealing precisely with the mind and the way you experience the world. Well, you know, I was just like any of those boys in France.
Yeah.
I was raised completely agnostic. But when I was 15, 16, I started reading a lot. And also, I have an uncle who was a great explorer, who is still alive.
Right. What was he, a solo yachtsman or something?
Jacques-Yves Le Tourmelin was the last of the great solo navigator on sail without any engine. So he went around the world after the Second World War on a 10-meter-long yacht. And he was one of the four or five classics of those who circumambulated of the globe, you know, taking their time. And beautiful adventures. So while he was doing the circumambulation, he was also reading books about Hinduism, Sufism. And he became a kind of, I won't say mystic, but certainly it was something that we would discuss a lot when I was going for holidays in his home. So I started reading about all those great traditions. And even including Christian mystics, like the early Orthodox writings and Master Eckhart and... Yeah. You know, everything you can think of. Mm-hmm. And it's something that really mattered to me. At the same time, there was no living tradition. There was no connection except to reading and discussion, which was, of course, it's an important step.
Right, but it was quite cerebral.
It's very cerebral. Mm-hmm. Although there was some aspiration and some kind of respect, but I didn't know how to formalize that. But that was still, quite a sort of politically very leftist type.
Yes, well, and also, I mean, really when I read about your parents and the world you grew up in, it's quite a charmed childhood. I mean, you were surrounded by brilliant people and artists, great thinkers.
Well, that recognition of the difference came a little bit later. Mm-hmm. So the turning point, the factual turning point, when I was 20, I then saw a series of documentaries with one of the Dalai Lama's interpreter for months and months. All the great masters over 2,000 kilometers of the Himalayas outside Tibet, the great Tibetan master who had fled the Chinese invasion from Bhutan to Sikkim to India to Dharamsala. And at the end of one of the documentaries, there was a series of faces of contemplatives, some great masters, some simple hermits, just in sort of meditation, looking straight at the camera. Probably they were not looking at the camera, but they were meditating and someone filmed them in silence. And that sort of building up of the strength of those faces, the strength of their presence, the strength of the silence. And what was also very remarkable is that they're all very different physically. Some very ascetic and skinny ones, some more round faces, some young, some older. But there was a common quality that's hard to describe, but is something to do with inner strength, compassion, unwavering quality of awareness, and all those things which constitute a true spiritual teacher.
Right.
And it's sort of like you hear about Saint Francis of Assisi, you hear about Socrates, you hear about Master Eckhart, and you say, you wonder how they look like. And there was those alive now.
Right.
So I must go there. So there I was, going on the train in India and finding Darjeeling and meeting those great masters.
I was really intrigued. Let's say this. I had a very different experience, but your story reminded me of this. When I was in my 20s, I was working in divided Berlin, and I ended up working in these very elevated circles of political strategy and military strategy. And my spiritual journey started when I kind of recoiled at the contrast between the importance of the issues and the intellectual and strategic substance of these people, the contrast between that and the very small inner lives a lot of them had. And I read a kind of similar observation that you wrote, because you were surrounded by, you met Stravinsky and Brunel, but you said, you can be a genius in your field and yet remain a dreadful person in daily life.
Well, yes, I don't want only to accent the dreadful person. What I mean is that there is no obvious connection.
Right. But so, what's so fascinating to me is what you were attracted to was this embodiment, these lives of integrity. And it was really experiential rather than intellectual at that point.
Because it struck me, retrospectively almost, I sort of thinking, well, all these wonderful people, great scientists, musicians, philosophers, painters, ordinary folks. You find a good distribution of everything.
Right.
Wonderful, warm-hearted people. Yeah. You feel so good to be with them. And then, people who are grumpy and not very altruistic and so forth. So therefore, it didn't seem that to become a scientist or to become a philosopher will make you necessarily a good human being.
Right.
Now, a spiritual teacher, if you say, he's a great spiritual teacher, but besides that, he's so grumpy, doesn't work. can't.
Yeah.
This is what you're looking for saying this is an authentic spiritual teacher. So there has to be a perfect adequation. And also, it has to be not a facade. There's so many, unfortunately, of those who look very impressive. And then if you scratch a little bit the surface or if you wait long enough, you will see that there are sides of them that's not fit with what they're supposed to be. So the messenger has to be the message, and it has to be integrally the message.
Mm-hmm.
And what is most remarkable, having lived then for almost 40 years with great spiritual masters, is that, for instance, my second great teacher, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who was one of the teachers to the Dalai Lama. And I was day and night with him because I became close disciple and attendant. One of the two monks, I would sleep in his room at night, helping to get up if he needed so. When he would wake up to do his meditation at 4 in the morning, I would wake up and serve him hot water or whatever.
Mm.
So all the time, when he was giving teaching, when he was traveling, when he was meeting kings, when he was meeting farmers, and over 15 years to see that absolute coherence and consistency in every aspect of that person's life, like the Dalai Lama. You know, see him in public, in private, in any circumstances. Mm-hmm. He's just such an extraordinary good human being.
Right.
There's no hidden side of it. So that was most inspiring.
Right.
Because you say, that's what I could become. Here is someone who did it. So therefore, it's possible.
Krista Tippett on Being, conversation about meaning, religion, ethics, and ideas. Today, the happiest man in the world, meeting Matthieu Ricard. Matthieu Ricard first became widely known in the West with the publication of the 1998 book, The Monk and the Philosopher. It documents a dialogue between him and his father, who took the pen name Jean-François Revel and was a pillar of 20th century French intellectual life. Asked by his father as their dialogue opened why he left his promising scientific career for a Buddhist path, Matthieu Ricard says this: "My scientific career was the result of a passion for discovery. Whatever I was able to do afterward was in no way a rejection of scientific research, but arose rather from the realization that such research was unable to solve the fundamental questions of life and wasn't even meant to do so." Ricard continues, "At the same time, I was becoming more and more interested in the spiritual life in terms of a contemplative science." There's a book that was published, which was in the form of a dialogue between you and your father, The Monk and the Philosopher, it was called. And you know, it's really clear that he was very proud of you. He was very proud of what you were accomplishing.
Well, not in the beginning.
When you were heading towards your career in science as a cell biologist, and you presented your dissertation to Nobel winners, and you were working at the Pasteur Institute. And then, you know, he writes, "You abandoned your career in order to commit yourself completely to Buddhist practice." And it seems to me that he felt where you could have pursued this career in science and you could have made discoveries that were about things that were new, and instead you went back to something that had been around for thousands of years.
Yeah, I thought that was a waste. I mean, waste of potential. But what I really, really am grateful is that he didn't show that. Mm-hmm. And so there was no slamming of doors when I left. Both my boss, François Jacob, Nobel Prize, and he didn't understand either.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I saw him 25 years later, he kept on looking at me and said, "Oh, you look good, you look good." So, not too bad.
But I think what intrigues me is the line that was there for you, because I think for you, it was less of a departure from your curiosity, your passion for discovery as a scientist. Here's something you wrote in another book, which was a form of a dialogue, The Quantum and the Lotus, which I really loved. Is there a solid reality behind appearances? What is the origin of the world of phenomena, the world that we see as real all around us? What is the relationship between the animate and the inanimate, between the subject and the object? Do time, space, and the laws of nature really exist? Buddhist philosophers have been studying these questions for the last 2,500 years.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this idea, oh, how can you go from Pasteur Institute to the Himalayas? What a break.
Right.
There's no break. And of course, you change rooms, you change clothes, you move from one place to another, but there's a continuity in what you do, unless you are forced by a tragic, dramatic event or you become mad. So in my case, I was very happy to be at Pasteur Institute. I think that scientific training helped me a lot to have at least some kind of rigorous mind. But then that was it. You know, to stay another few years, then I would have felt sort of like an animal caught in a trap. That was no more what I aspired to. And then, fortunately, I didn't have to wait till I was retired at 62 or something to to start that.
Right. So, you know, Einstein felt that Buddhism was perhaps the religion of the future that could reconcile the best insights of science and spirituality. And
you know, it's amazing, that quote of Einstein.
Yeah.
It's typically Einstein's style.
Yeah.
But we would never, never trace it to a precise speech or something. But everyone agrees that it sounds very much like Einstein's mm-hmm. writing or speech.
Yeah, I haven't heard it so much as a quote as an idea. I mean, it's more where his mind was going.
It's a beautiful quote.
Yes.
And it really says that it's the one that fits with the
that it can
cosmological
reconcile
vision,
these
that can reconcile
or
everything.
Hold them together mm-hmm. in a creative tension. And then it really intrigues me because I think that this Mind and Life initiative of the Dalai Lama that you're also part of is a 21st century manifestation of that.
Yes.
That idea. So
yes, you see,
that.
Dalai Lama himself was always been so interested in science. He said, possibly he had not been Dalai Lama, I would have been an engineer. He says when he sees tools, he has a hard time keeping his hand off. He's teasing. But from an early age, you know, he was very curious mind, very inquisitive mind. And so when he came in exile, one of his wishes was to meet with great scientists. He met with Karl Popper, with great quantum physicist, and then more and more with psychologists and neuroscientists. So when they saw that, some of them got the idea of creating that Mind and Life Institute. You know, Francisco Varela, a great neuroscientist, Adam Engel, mm-hmm. who is a former businessman or the chairman of Mind and Life, to facilitate this dialogue. First of all, was just to bring them together and have this wonderful small scale dialogue, 5 or 6 scientists, maybe 20 observers, and that was it. But then it quickly turned out that the discussion was so lively, so enriching from both sides. There was not just coaching the Dalai Lama, they were also learning a lot from his kind of mind.
Right.
And that it became a little bit bigger. Some public events start to happen, like the first one at MIT. It was investigating
when
the mind.
John Kabat-Zinn was involved.
Was
in that
2003.
Well.
Was a quite a groundbreaking. There was 1,000 scientists there, and Nobel prizes and so forth. But also, the idea of starting a research program, that because Buddhism considers itself as an empirical approach of the functioning of the mind, the mechanism of happiness and suffering. And so empirical means, we can certainly work with scientists without any risk of feeling threatened by that, because if something is false, it's false. Right. What's the problem with that?
Right.
So in 2000, following one of the meetings that was devoted to destructive emotions, the first one to myself, I participated in Dharamsala for 5 days. And halfway through the week, His Holiness sort of one morning is his typical common sense approach said, well, all this is very nice, but what can we contribute to society?
Some of the scientists present at that exchange responded to the Dalai Lama's challenge by creating a rigorous research program, using scientific protocol to investigate the tangible, physiological effects of meditation. Some of the most highly influential studies have been done by Richard Davidson of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Such research might one day yield new understanding of the mind, of the ultimate nature of human consciousness. But even the earliest experiments with serious long-term meditators began to change the field of neuroscience by providing original evidence that the human brain alters across the lifespan, a capacity known as neuroplasticity. You were one of those meditators, one of the referred to as Olympic meditators. As you said, people who have meditated more than 10,000 hours or something.
Yeah,
like
I think
that.
I calculated roughly at 40,000, but probably most of them like completely distracted. I don't know, but in numbers
right.
I did. But yes, because I was at that first meeting and I was from both worlds.
Yeah.
I volunteered because I thought it was fun and I was very interested and curious.
So and this was with Richard Davidson.
Richard Davidson. So I was the first guinea pig, let's say.
I've
and then this program has taken strength, and now many labs, there's at least 5 or 6 major laboratories in the United States and in Europe who are now doing very in-depth research, not only in long-term meditators, but also which is more probably relevant to our world,
practical.
With short-term meditation, like 8 weeks, 20 minutes a day. What does change does that bring? And that also gives remarkable results.
Right. I've seen pictures of you hooked up to all the electrodes. It looks like some kind of alien headdress. help me understand what's been learned, at least part of what's been learned. what surprised the scientists. As you say, it's no surprise that there's a physical correlate, that you're meditating and that in that moment they might see something happening in your brain. But I think that one of the learnings that challenged some thinking was that these changes were permanent, right?
Yes.
That even when you weren't meditating, the gamma waves were present and were different.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, first of all, I think it was very much needed to show that long-term or even short-term mind training. You spoke of neuroplasticity. What does that mean? Plasticity means the brain can change functionally and possibly structurally following a training. Actually, this is one of the major discovery in neuroscience for the last 20 years, not only at all with meditation. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, it was thought that the adult brain can't change anymore right. because it will make a huge mess. It's so complex that you cannot fiddle around with that. Then they found that birds that learn new songs, the brain change, musicians that play 10,000 hours of violin, the area of the brain that has to do with the coordination of the finger is vastly increased, that the London cab drivers who have to learn 20,000 streets by heart, the area that has to do with the topology right. is vastly increased. So what about compassion? What about focused attention? Basically, it's just another skill. Of course, it's a skill that matters more in your life. You know, compassion obviously matters more than learning 20,000 streets, except for taxi driver, probably they need both.
Right. Yeah.
But those are such basic human qualities that if you can cultivate them, you can imagine how crucial it is. And so to establish that meditation is not just like a nice relaxation where you empty your mind, those cliches that are still attached to the notion of meditation, mm-hmm. that's why we prefer the idea of mind training and to rest in the perfect transparency and the freshness of the present moment is not a strenuous exercise, but it's something that requires experience. Now, the question about the ultimate nature of consciousness, of course, that's not what we are looking for right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I think science right now could address that question except on the philosophical level. But if you want, we can go into detail about the Buddhist reasoning about nature of consciousness could be something
that's
else.
That's what I'd like. I'd like to know how you think about it.
And
it's clear that there's one way that science can define it at this point.
Okay.
How do you explain what they found?
Let's see. Yeah. You have what we call primary phenomena. You know, look at matter. You know, the famous question of Leibniz, where there is something rather than nothing? Well, you say, well, there is something, whatever it is. You just have to acknowledge that the phenomenal world is there. Now, consciousness. You can study it in different ways. What we basically call the third-person approach means looking from the outside, and the first-person approach, looking into your experience. So third-person approach is very clear, is what neuroscience does better and better, is whenever people think, have emotions, or just are alive, something happened in their brain.
Yep.
And you can describe that in increasingly sophisticated details. And when someone sees red, or someone feels love, you could describe right down to the most single neurons what's going on if you had the power of investigation. But you have no clue what it means to see red, feel love as an experience. So that's the first person. Now, I mean, a great neuroscientist told me there's no mind, there's just brain function. Okay, fine.
Okay.
Brain functions. But we have experience. Nobody can deny that. And actually, that experience is primary to anything. There was no science without experience. We could not conceive of the brain without experience. Without experience, forget about the world. There is something very fundamental. That's the basic cognitive quality of mind. You can call that basic awareness. You can call it a fundamental aspect of consciousness. The most basic quality that you know rather than you don't know. Just like in matter, there's right. something rather than nothing.
Right.
In Buddhism, we call it the luminous aspect of mind. Not that it shines lights in the dark, but luminous because that's what illuminates your world. It's like a torchlight, a light that allows you to see things.
Hmm.
But light is the fundamental thing that doesn't change if light shines on a heap of garbage, it doesn't become dirty, it just reveals it.
Right.
If light shines upon a diamond, it's not become expensive, it just reveals the diamond. So there's a fundamental component that's basic consciousness. So now you can say that from that perspective, that this is also a primary phenomena. So that's the Buddhist reasoning. It corresponds to experience. And that's just an open possibility for investigation.
Find some documented words of Einstein that evocatively echo Matthieu Ricard's perspective and this conversation. In a letter to a man at the World Jewish Congress, Einstein wrote, "A human being is a part of the whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. The striving to free oneself from this delusion is the one issue of true religion. Not to nourish the delusion, but to try to overcome it, is the way to reach the attainable measure of peace of mind." Part of this quote from Einstein is included in The Universe in a Grain of Sand, a chapter from Matthieu Ricard's book, The Quantum and the Lotus. Read an excerpt at onbeing.org. And on our blog, discover the adventurous backstory to verifying this quote and see an image of Einstein's actual letter from 1950. You can watch a video of my entire unedited conversation with Matthieu Ricard or download a free MP3 of this show. Find those links and much more, again, on being.org. Coming up, Matthieu Ricard's intriguing definition of the meaning of happiness. Also, his take on the relationship between humor and wisdom. I'm Krista Tippett. This program comes to you from APM, American Public Media. I'm Krista Tippett. Today on Being, I'm with Tibetan Buddhist spiritual teacher Matthieu Ricard. I sat down with him in Vancouver, Canada, at a series of gatherings with the Dalai Lama together with scientists, educators, and activists. His 2000 book, The Quantum and the Lotus, captures a dialogue he had about science and Buddhism with astrophysicist Trinh Hoan Thuan. Thuan was born Buddhist in Vietnam and became a scientist. Ricard grew up in a secular family in France, trained as a scientist, and became a Tibetan Buddhist monk. Both were intrigued by correlations they traced between the way quantum physicists describe matter and energy and the way Buddhists understand the interdependence and impermanence of human experience and all of life.
So it was another great encounter. I met Trinh Hoan Thuan in Andorra, in the Pyrenees. Okay. We were both invited to some summer university. And immediately he said, you know, I'm born in Vietnam, born a Buddhist. I always wanted to have a dialogue about Buddhism and astrophysics or modern science. We did that. It was wonderful. The most fascinating thing I learned through this dialogue was precisely about something very deep about the nature of reality, related to interdependence and impermanence. And interdependence, of course, in modern physics is slightly different, is non-localization.
Right.
The fact that if one photon or particle split into two and they shoot out at basically any distance in the universe, they still remain part of a whole.
Right.
So there's something there that is still not separate.
Right.
So that was incredible insight for me, because interdependence is not just the fact that things are related, but also that therefore they are devoid of totally autonomous, independent existence. Anything, beautiful, ugly, red, blue, any characteristic comes through relation. Relation co-define an object. Like take a rainbow in the sky. Well, it looks very beautiful, very, very vivid and clear. You'll think that that rainbow has something existing on its own. Now, behind you, you mask the rays of sun, and there is not a speck of existence of that rainbow that remains. It's all gone because you remove something, an element of set of relation that crystallized that rainbow somehow as a phenomena. The idea is it's the same for every single phenomena. Nothing exists on its own, and that has profound repercussions in Buddhism, not only as a philosophical idea, but also the way we grasp to the world. If you grasp to something as being mine, therefore that object exists on its own.
And, I mean, would you also say that a human analogy would be this phenomenon of globalization?
Well, and it leads to what the Dalai Lama calls the sense of universal responsibility.
Right.
And now more and more leaders are speaking of interdependence, and I hear that word again and again, recently in Bill Clinton's mouth, about the world is interdependent.
Right.
And it is true. You know, we are interdependent, even I would say even more deeply than what we mostly think. But that leads to also the sense of interdependency is at the root of altruism and compassion. That's one of the consequences of understanding interdependence. You know, if you think of separate entities, well, I'm a separate entity as well. So, what do? I create a small bubble, a self-centered bubble, and I take care of my own happiness because, after all, I am this separate entity, so I just have to build my own happiness, and that's fine.
Right.
Everyone will become happy in their own bubble, and then the world will be fine. Well, if it would work, okay, but this is not working. Why? Not just because of moral issue, because it's bad to be self-centered, because it's dysfunctional, because it's at odds with reality.
Right.
So it doesn't work.
Right. I want to talk about happiness. You've been labeled the happiest man in the world coming out of these Davidson experiments.
Totally artificial. I issued about 1,000 disclaimers, but nobody cares.
You did. They didn't get covered. I did identify with some of the things that you've written that when you were younger, you thought that happiness was not necessarily a very laudable goal. I mean, I
didn't have no idea about it, basically.
Right, but it, you know, you're worldly wise and rational, and we also live in this culture where the word happiness gets completely watered down. And so I want to just talk about how you define happiness, because we have to put a lot of...
Yeah, that's very important, because that's why also this word is so vague.
Yeah,
it's that, a problem. You know, you can use it, you know, buy this toothpaste and you'll be happy, you know, okay, good luck. So I think we should clearly see what are the inner conditions that foster a genuine sense of flourishing, of fulfillment, that the quality of every instant of your life has a certain quality that you appreciate fully. So, you see, it's very different from people who sometimes imagine that constant happiness will be a kind of euphoria or endless succession of pleasant experiences.
Right.
Now, that's more like a recipe for exhaustion than happiness.
Right.
And also, if you look at the parameters, this is very different. Pleasure depends very much on circumstances, what triggers it. Then it's a sensation in a way. So sensation change from pleasurable to neutral and to unpleasurable. I mean, even the most pleasurable thing, you eat something very delicious. Once it's delicious, 2-3 times, okay. And then 10 times you get nauseous.
Yeah.
You are very cold and shivering. You come near a bonfire, such a delight. But then after a few minutes, you start, okay, then you move back. It's too hot.
Right.
The most beautiful music, you hear it 5 times, 24 hours is a nightmare.
Yeah.
And also, it's something that basically doesn't radiate to others. You can experience pleasure at the cost of others' suffering. So it's very vulnerable to the change of outer circumstances. It doesn't help you to face the outer circumstances better.
Right.
Now, if we think of happiness as a way of being, a way of being that gives you the resources to deal with the ups and downs of life, that pervades all the emotional state, including sadness.
Right.
So if you think of sadness, it's incompatible with pleasure, but it's compatible with what? With altruism, with inner strength, with inner freedom, with sense of direction and meaning in life. Oh, they are sad things. But if you don't fall in despair, still you maintain that that wholeness and that sense of purpose and meaning.
So this happiness also, the way you describe it, is something that can encompass sadness and grief.
Can what?
Encompass,
it
contain
can encompass
these
every
things.
Mental state, except those who are just opposite, which is like despair, hatred, precisely the mental factors that will destroy inner peace, inner strength, inner
right.
freedom. If you are under the grip of hatred, you are not free. You are the slave of your own thoughts. Mm-hmm. So that's not freedom. Therefore, this is opposite to genuine flourishing and happiness.
So I imagine that people ask you, how do I become happy? I mean, what do you say? How do you respond
well,
to that?
Well, clearly by first saying, yes, outer circumstances are important. I should do whatever I can. But I should certainly see that at the root of all that, there are inner circumstances, inner conditions. What are they? Well, just look at you. Now, if I say, okay, come, we'll spend the weekend cultivating jealousy. Now, who is going to go for that? We all know that, even say, well, that's part of human nature, but we are not interested in cultivating more jealousy, neither for hatred, neither for arrogance. So those, we will be much better off if they were not didn't have such a grip on our mind. Mm. So there are ways to counteract those, to dissolve those. I mean, you cannot in the same moment of thought wish to do something good to someone or harm that person. So those are mutually incompatible, like hot and cold water. So the more you will bring benevolence in your mind, at every of those moments, there is no space for hatred. That's just very simple, but we don't do that. Now, we do exercise every morning, 20 minutes to be fit. We don't sit for 20 minutes to cultivate compassion. If we were to do so, our mind will change, our brain will change, what we are will change. So those are skills. They need to be first identified, then cultivated. What is good to learn chess? Well, you have to practice and all that. In the same way, we all have thoughts of altruistic love.
Right.
Who didn't have that? But they come and go. We don't cultivate them.
Right.
You learn the piano by playing 20 seconds every 2 weeks? It doesn't work. So why, by what kind of mystery, some of the most important quality of human beings will be optimal just because you wish so? Doesn't make any sense. Right. I have a friend who is 63 years old. He used to be a runner when he was young. He gave up running. Now, a few years ago, he started again. He said, when I started again, I could not run more than 5 minutes without panting for breath. Now, last week, he ran the Montreal Marathon at 63. He had that potential, but it was useless until he actualized it.
Mm-hmm.
So same potential we have for mind training, but if we don't do anything, it's not going to happen because we wish so.
What you're talking about is a life discipline, and it has
well,
to do
I mean,
with
myself,
the everyday
if
as well.
I was struck by that we need to put that in action in a way. Or action doesn't mean like frantically running around all day long, which I'm unfortunately doing a bit too much. being the exemplifying that in our life. So that's what led me. My only regret some years ago was not to have hands down trying to serve others. So when I had the possibility of doing that, I jumped into that. And I'm absolutely grateful and delighted that I can now we treat 100,000 patients in the Himalayas, India, Tibet, and Nepal. We have 15 kids in the school that we built. It's not huge compared to some other big organization, but at least we did our best. So my motto, in a way, will be to transform yourself to better serve others.
Right.
If you see in the humanitarian world, grains of sand that bring everything to an halt, is corruption, clashes of egos, human factors, more than resources. So how to avoid that? Those are lack of human maturity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not vain or futile exercise to perfect yourself to some extent before you serve others. Otherwise, it's like cutting the wheat when it's still green, and nobody is fed by that. So we need a minimum of readiness to efficiently and wisely be at the service of others. So compassion needs also to be enlightened by wisdom, otherwise it's blind.
I'm Krista Tippett on Being, conversation about meaning, religion, ethics, and ideas. Today, the happiest man in the world, with biologist, Tibetan Buddhist monk, and spiritual teacher Matthieu Ricard. I sat down with him at a conference in Vancouver, headlined by the Dalai Lama. This gathering that we're at, and I think you find yourself in many gatherings like this, where there's a collection of wise people, people who are practicing these things and finding an integrity. And here, you know, the Dalai Lama was here. There were a number of Nobel Peace Prize winners. And several people have said, and I hear this also in conversations I have, that we might be on the cusp of some kind of spiritual evolution, that people may, in fact, human beings may, in fact, be learning something. And I think the fact that science is taking these spiritual disciplines, these spiritual technologies like meditation more seriously, are one manifestation of that. And yet, we will go back to the places we live in, and there's also outside gatherings like this, we're then confronted again with a great deal that's wrong in the world. And I wonder what your perspective is on where we are as a species, as a planet right now.
I think ideas change slowly, but sometimes they are tipping points. Mm-hmm. For instance, the environment, I don't know, 35 years ago or 40 years ago when Rachel Carson's book, right, Silent Spring, came out, I was a teenager, a bird watcher, and for us it was a revelation. Yeah. But we were just this kind of lovers of nature, and nobody cared for that, and they thought it was just crazy ideas. Now it's a major preoccupation. It took a certain number of years, but it was all there already. So ideas like we should work towards a more altruistic and compassionate society is taking momentum, because also now it's not more a luxury. It becomes a necessity. Yeah. So what is an evolution pressure is when it's sort of necessary for survival. So in ancient times, it's maybe fine for tribes to fight each other over hunting grounds or whatever. Nowadays, with precisely this interdependence and this globality, we are all part of one family. That's not just a nice, naive image. No. Right. Either we're all losers or all winners in terms of survival. No, we can't say that it makes sense for just one nation to be powerful, rich, and so forth. If the whole world is starving, that will create immense wars and difficulties. And the environment can only be a transnational solution. So hopefully, evolution will take hold quickly enough so that altruistic behavior become and not just seemingly altruistic behavior, which is selfishness in disguise, but right, real concern for all. Because after all, the true altruism is a genuine consideration for all sentient beings, whether they are your tribe, your relatives, or your own gene lines. Forget about that. It has now to be concern for all that lives.
Something that I see as a characteristic of you. Okay, so you've issued disclaimers that you're not the happiest man alive.
I just want to say that.
Yeah.
It's just taken by an English newspaper.
Yeah.
It's not based on scientific data. I apologize to my scientist friend. It is better than to be labeled the most unhappy person in the world. Fine. But it rests on no scientific evidence.
But let me just say this. A quality of you and of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and other very wise people I've come across, spiritual people, serious people, it's also a very robust sense of humor. Right? He's always laughing. He's funny.
Yes.
And even before I met you, when I've seen pictures of you, you always have a smile on your face. And I want to know, where does humor come into this, to wisdom?
Well, humor comes with, you know, when you are not, first of all, you know, if the ego is not such a target that is always there, exposed to all the arrows of praise and blame and criticism and all that, and you are not too much, you know, susceptible to that, basically you don't care to start with. You know, nothing to lose, nothing to gain from all this noise of, oh, you are such a great guy, or you are just a bastard. You know, it's just like, what does it mean? It's like egos. Doesn't care. So it gives the sense of less vulnerability. It's a real strength. People think that a strong ego is a strength. Strong ego is ultimate vulnerability. You know, you are so preoccupied with that strong ego, you can't sleep anymore.
Right.
But if his ego is transparent, you know, so fine. So a sort of lightness. And then also, because you have this real confidence, not come from strong ego, but you are much more available to others, so open to the world.
Right.
You know, I see that in Tibet very often. You know, sometimes you find a very difficult situation. Our car, when we do those projects and schools and clinics, we get stuck in the middle of a river with our car. You know, big stream, it's raining. You know, everybody will just, you can imagine some people screaming, you know, upset. Usually it ends up, everyone is on top of the car cracking into laughter. They think it's such a funny thing. So this is a kind of, you know, we do our best and these things happen, and why should you take it too seriously? Because, you know, we'll survive that hopefully. And after all, what's the problem? Just one part of the journey. And it's so much more fun if you take it like that than, you know, making all these tantrums about things.
Right.
It's just precisely what that we were mentioning before, the way you interpret the world. You know, I gave this example which struck me. I was sitting outside our monastery once, and it was monsoon time in Nepal, lot of mud and water, and we had put some bricks over about 20 to 30 meters to go from one brick to the other to cross that mess. And one person came, a foreigner, and that person was just screaming, oh, it's disgusting, this place, and wow, and look, and then she came, I was sitting there, and she's going to scold me for just there being. And then, so, okay. Then, 5 minutes later, another person came, were two ladies, and she was just hopping from one to the other, saying, oh, it's so nice, it's such a fun. Right. And when there is rain, there's no dust, and she was exactly the same situation. And she had a sense of lightness and humor. The other one was just like grumbling like crazy about it. So, same situation, different perspective.
Hmm. All right, that's your last word. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Matthieu Ricard is founder of the humanitarian organization Karuna Sechen. He served as the Dalai Lama's French interpreter for over two decades. His books include Happiness, A Guide to Developing Life's Most Important Skill, and The Quantum and the Lotus, A Journey to the Frontiers Where Science and Buddhism Meet. At onbeing.org, you can see the documentary footage of Tibetan faces that changed the direction of Matthieu Ricard's life, and find some of the photography that he's created these past 40 years as he's immersed himself in the light and the humanity of the Himalayas, images from the monastery in Kathmandu where he currently resides, and his bamboo schools. Finally, as always, you can download this show or watch and listen to my unedited interview with Matthieu Ricard. Like us at facebook.com/onbeing. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle @beingtweets. Again, there are links to all of this at onbeing.org. This program is produced by Chris Heagle, Nancy Rosenbaum, and Susan Leem. Anne Breckbill is our web developer. Trent Gillis is senior editor. Kate Moose is executive producer. And I'm Krista Tippett.
On Being is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. On Being is extending its reach throughout America with support from Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private foundation.
Next time, Jean Berko Gleason, a pioneer in understanding how children learn language. We have a playful and wide-ranging conversation on the human gift, not merely to be conscious, but to comment on that. Please join us. This is APM, American Public Media.